History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everybody, welcome back to our series on travelers and explorers. This is the final episode in the series. We're wrapping things up with the age of Arctic exploration. And there are a lot of people we could choose from here, but I'm going to go with one of the better known ones who, honestly, any way you slice it, has one of the best stories, and that is Ernest Shackleton. Let's start in the middle of the action when his ship is sinking in Antarctica. When Ernest Shackleton finally gave the order for his men to abandon ship, it wasn't altogether clear if the crew would find the solid pack ice that trapped the Endurance any more hospitable than the rising waters. The crew had fought for 3 solid days to save their ship. The engineers maintained steam in the boilers to operate the engine room pumps, working for almost 17.2 hours constantly. Seamen Walter Howe and William Bakewell pumped out water for the ship for nearly as long, but they couldn't do anything to stop the outside ice from crushing the hull. 10 million tons slammed the outsides of the Endurance. Its thick timbers crack, its frames and planking groaned. The timbers broke with an explosion that startled the crew. Its sides bowed in 6 inches under the pressure. Following the captain's orders, the crew quietly abandoned ship. As Alfred Lansing recounts in Endurance, Shackleton's incredible voyage, the crew, carpenters, engineers, and seamen filed out to the main deck. There they approached a piece of canvas that the dog team drivers had attached to the port rail as a makeshift slide that led to the ice along the ship. The team slid the 49 Huskies down to the men waiting below before sliding themselves down, taking one last look at the Endurance, their home for over a year. The team of sailors worked with quiet urgency, despite their exhaustion, to transfer their essential gear to the ice. They stood among the piles of food, provisions, tents, and stores, along with lifeboats that had been lowered onto the ice the night before. The temperature dropped to 8 degrees below 0°F. The Endurance sunk an hour after the last man was off. After the uprights had caved in, the boat finally yielded to the great pressure. Water gushed in through the holes, followed by massive chunks of ice. The front half of the ship was soon submerged. It was a sobering moment for the captain, as abandoning ship was the lowest point in any captain's life. It was admitting total failure. Most naval careers ended in these cases, and even if they didn't, the pride of the captain rarely survived. But Ernest Shackleton had little time for despair. He took stock of their new home, the icy surface, and looked into the distance. There was nothing but ice ridges and cracks extended to the end of the horizon. The wasteland of Antarctica was a bleak world of bergs and upthrustings, with the ice pack always squeezing, moaning, rumbling, snapping, or roaring. The blasts of breaking pack ice were one of the few sounds that broke up the howl of the screaming wind. He may have felt a bit of remorse in leading the men to their possible deaths, but it wasn't as if he hadn't warned them of the dangers of the voyage before their departure from England. Shackleton took pains to make the full measure of the trip's dangers as clear as possible to any would-be adventurers. According to legend, he posted this bold advertisement in the Times of London on December 29, 1913. Men wanted for a hazardous journey. Low wages, bitter cold, long hours of complete darkness. Safe return doubtful. Honor and recognition in event of success. Now again, we don't know if this advertisement is real or not, but anyone who was applying to such a voyage should have known the risks after decades of Arctic exploration in England and stories of bitter cold and death for people who went on such voyages. Well, thousands of men did apply for the voyage, along with 3 women, who responded to the challenge and promise of terrible adventure. His Imperial Trans-Antarctic Expedition was an attempt to make the first land crossing of the Antarctic continent. And Shackleton's promise of glory in the case of success was not an embellishment. Crossing the icy continent was among the last milestones of human exploration, since Roald Amundsen had already reached the South Pole in 1911 and crossed the Northwest Passage years earlier in a small boat that hugged the northern coast of Canada. There were few opportunities left on Earth for a true pioneer, and his applicants knew it. The mission failed in its primary objective of crossing the ice-entombed continent, but it attained a more noble legacy for the feat of endurance. Men braved the worst climate on Earth with poor provisions and inadequate cold weather gear, but they only lost 1 sailor at sea. Their survival depended on bravery, considerable luck, belief in their rescue, and resourcefulness to adapt to these conditions. They were pushed to their absolute breaking point and the limits for them physically and mentally, and often beyond. Most of all, they had complete faith in their captain, Shackleton. In the course of their ill-fated adventure, the men were stranded deep in the waste of the Weddell Sea, at 69.5 degrees south, 5130 degrees west, stuck halfway between the South Pole and the nearest outpost, located 1,200 miles north. Over a year had passed since the crew had contact with the outside world. No rescue mission would come to them for years, or if at all, since their location was nearly inaccessible to anyone but a select few, and most of those men had already volunteered for this voyage. As such, rescue would come from no one except themselves. Shackleton put together a plan to march 346 miles northwest across the heavy pack ice to reach Paulet Island, where 12 years earlier a rescue ship deposited its stocks of stores for any later castaways. The sailors faced physical and emotional challenges experienced by very few in history. Arctic exploration in the 19th century has been considered by some historians as the absolute outer limits of misery and difficulty for explorers and their party. You really couldn't face harsher conditions in any time or any place, whether you're on the Silk Road and you're exposed to bandits, whether you're doing exploration in Africa or the Amazon in the jungle. But for these explorers, they did have one advantage. They had a captain who had incredible luck for succeeding in the midst of failure. He fought doggedly for survival and inspired his team when they were plunged into an Arctic abyss. Out of this failed voyage, Shackleton emerged as the last great figure in the heroic age of Antarctic exploration. Ernest Henry Shackleton was born in 1874 in Athy, Ireland. He was the second of 10 siblings. During his childhood, his father Henry chose to sell their land in the Irish countryside and moved the family to Dublin so he could study medicine at Trinity College. They relocated to suburban London 4 years later for employment for the new doctor, but also to escape tensions between the Irish and the Anglo-Irish, of which the Shackletons were part. City life suited Ernest, who was a voracious reader, particularly of adventure books. Victorian libraries had stacks of adventure books written for boys, telling stories about Captain Cook, Stanley, Livingston, and British military officers stationed in the colonies of Africa, Australia, and India, who, in these books, tamed wild lands and brought them under control for the glory of the Queen and her empire. He attended Fir Lodge Preparatory School and later Dulwich College. In his final term, he placed 5th out of 31, with little distinction as a student. Here he read prose and poetry, which later animated his travel accounts. His descriptions of troubles in the Arctic landscape were later praised by critics for their literary qualities. Shackleton longed for the sea and left Dulwich at age 16, against his father's wishes for him to enter the medical field. He arrived at Liverpool an apprentice with the Northwestern Shipping Company aboard the Hotten Tower. He had his first taste of the Antarctic shortly after, when the Hotten Tower rounded Cape Horn to reach the Valparaiso, Chile, during its main voyage. They rounded the Horn in the dead of winter, fighting storms and fierce winds from the south for 2 months. The ship finally reached the harbor of Valparaiso in August, battered by the seas. The ship returned to Liverpool 8 months later, with low supplies of food and water. But the experience didn't deter the 16-year-old from a life at sea. If nothing else, it gave him a stronger resolve. Shackleton spent the next 5 years learning maritime skills by sailing around the world. He passed for first mate in 1896 and certified as a master in 1898. The rank of Master Mariner allowed him to command any civilian ship under the British flag. In 1898, Shackleton joined the Union Castle Line, a prominent shipping line which belonged to the elite of the merchant service and operated a fleet of passenger liners and cargo ships between Europe and Africa. He ferried mail and passengers from Southampton, England, to Cape Town, South Africa. With the outbreak of the Boer War in South Africa, he transferred to the Tintagel Castle. Aboard this vessel, Shackleton met Army Lieutenant Cedric Longstaff, who assisted him in obtaining an interview with his father, Llewellyn. The famed Lieutenant Colonel was an industrialist and chief private sector patron of the National Antarctic Expedition, tasked with the British exploration of Antarctica. The other Longstaff was so impressed with Shackleton's maritime talent and interest in exploration that he eventually appointed the young Master Mariner as third officer aboard Discovery, a ship bound for the southern continent. Shortly thereafter, Shackleton was granted the rank of sub-lieutenant in the Royal Naval Reserve. British polar expeditions offered chances for incredible glory. If the captain of a polar expedition survived, he was typically knighted and given a parade, even if most of the men on his expedition died. When Sir John Franklin left for Canada in 1825 to map the northern Canadian coast, He trudged across frozen lands for hundreds of miles, leading 16 men. They were forced to winter for months at Fort Franklin and faced starvation conditions. They subsisted for months on lichen scraped from rocks and even ate the leather from their shoes. When he returned to England in 1827, he was knighted by King George IV, then made a knight commander of a royal order by King William IV in 1836, then made a knight of the Greek Order of the Redeemer. The Admiralty awarded him captaincy of the HMS Rainbow and sent him to the Mediterranean, the ideal destination for any captain of the Royal Navy and a pleasure cruise compared to Arctic exploration. But the dangers of such an expedition were the stuff of horror stories, which they became when sailors swapped tales of lost voyages during the night watch. One such tale involved another polar exploration led by John Franklin. He attempted a crossing of the Northwest Passage in 1845 with a crew of 134 while commanding two ships, the HMS Terror and Erebus. A year into their expedition, the two ships became trapped in ice off King William Island. The crew tried to reach safety on foot, but succumbed to terrible cold. Darkness persisted for over 100 days in the winter, and temperatures dropped to 50 or 60 degrees below zero, in which every breath was painful, and frostbite set in within minutes for exposed skin. Bare hands instantly froze to any metal surface, and the only way to free a hand was to pull it away and rip off a layer of skin. There, parkas couldn't deter cold when wet and managed to weigh down the wearer when drenched with sweat, weighing more than 30 pounds. When the crew couldn't find open waters, they became trapped and ate their last stores of food, many of which spoiled. When that ran out, some resorted to cannibalism. Others preferred starvation. Every single man on the Franklin expedition was lost. Shackleton knew all these stories, but he was a hopeless romantic who desired to complete a great voyage for the sake of his nation. He received his chance on Discovery, which was part of the first British expedition to Antarctica since the voyage of James Clark Ross 60 years earlier. It was led by Robert Scott, a Royal Navy torpedo lieutenant who had recently been promoted to commander. Although the ship and expedition weren't commissioned by the Royal Navy, the expedition was led with military precision and discipline. The crew voluntarily accepted the Code of Conduct of the Naval Discipline Act and ran the ship in the manner of a Royal Navy vessel. The ship set sail on July 31, 1901, and took 6 months to reach the Antarctic coast via Cape Town in New Zealand. Shackleton was tasked with maintaining the holds, stores, and provisions. He assisted in scientific tests as well, participating in an experimental balloon flight and the first exploratory sledging route from the expedition's winter quarters in McMurdo Sound to the Great Ice Barrier, the largest ice shelf in Antarctica. He also edited the South Polar Times, a magazine documenting the expedition during the Antarctic winter of 1902. On November 2, 1902, the commander chose Shackleton and a handful of his most trusted men to climb to the highest latitude possible adjacent to the South Pole. The trek was incredibly difficult, lasting 3 months in total, and ended in a combination of success and failure, as Scott later wrote. In the course of the journey, they reached a record of farthest south latitude, arriving at 82 degrees. But in the course of the journey, all 22 sled dogs died due to tainted food, and the men suffered from scurvy, frostbite, and snow blindness. Shackleton himself had taken ill upon his return when he reached the ships on February 3, 1903. He was sent home on the morning, a ship that had arrived to assist the Discovery the previous month. Shackleton spent a period of recovery in New Zealand and returned to England, where he found that he was something of a minor celebrity among the Admiralty due to being the first person to return from the Antarctic. They consulted Shackleton about navigational difficulties, necessary supplies, and other preparations for a relief operation for the Discovery. He advised their outfitting on the Terra Nova, as well as the Argentine corvette Uruguay, another relief ship sent to assist a stranded Swedish Antarctic expedition. Rather than returning south aboard the Terra Nova as its chief officer, Shackleton attempted to receive a commission in the Royal Navy via the supplementary list. He was denied. What followed was a series of side professions in the interregnum of his Arctic adventures. He accepted a position as a journalist for the Royal Magazine for a short period, followed by a secretaryship for the Royal Scottish Geographical Society in 1904. The next year, he became a shareholder in a speculative company that aimed to transport Russian troops home from the Far East at the conclusion of the Russo-Japanese War. It ultimately failed. Shackleton even attempted to enter politics as a Liberal Unionist Party member in the 1906 general election. During this time, Shackleton befriended William Beardmore, a wealthy industrialist who employed him as an assistant. Beardmore knew of Shackleton's desire to return to Antarctica as the head of his own expedition and offered him financial support. But Beardmore's contribution wasn't enough for a serious expedition, so Shackleton sought to acquire the necessary resources by other means. They came in the form of donations from his wealthy friends and acquaintances, including author Campbell McKellar and Guinness Baron Lord Eve, when he presented his plans for an Antarctic journey to the Royal Geographic Society. In their 1907 newsletter, he published his plans to conquer the South Pole and the South Magnetic Pole. With all his necessary funds secured and a crew hastily assembled, Shackleton ordered his 41-year-old ship Nimrod to set sail from the Littleton Harbor, New Zealand, for Antarctica in January 1908. Nimrod, a re-rigged whaling vessel, was towed 1,650 miles by a steamer to the Antarctic ice to conserve coal, which was used for the auxiliary steam engine and a small measure of heating. The ship arrived on the eastern portion of the Great Ice Barrier on January 21, 1908. There, they found a bay filled with hundreds of whales, which they later christened as the Bay of Whales. However, unstable ice conditions prevented the party from establishing a base. They eventually erected a base at Cape Royds in early February, at the height of the austral summer, when the sun didn't set for weeks and temperatures rose to negative 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Storms, however, struck hardest in the summer, covering their camp with a layer of ice and making the mass of the Nimrod, quote, gray with the frozen spray and the bows were a coat of mail, unquote. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. The party constructed their prefabricated hut and landed stores and equipment, turning it into a functional lodge. But the work was slowed down by poor weather and their fear that the sea ice wasn't sufficiently frozen for the party to cross and begin its journey the following spring. Reaching the South Pole was based on the idea of a military assault. The sailors would establish bases as far as possible into enemy territory, or in this case, the Arctic tundra, which in their minds was little different than a hostile force. They would sledge their goods to the next depot, whether pulled by pack animals or a primitive motor car, or pushing several hundred pounds in 16-hour days of sheer physical exertion. The final assault on the pole consisted of an elite team of trekkers that would make a rapid push, reach their destination and plant their flag, then return to friendly territory as quickly as possible. When Nimrod departed for the winter season to return months later, the sea ice broke up and preparatory sledging was still impossible. While awaiting better weather conditions for the South Pole journey, some team members undertook other expeditions. They prepared to summit Mount Erebus, a 12,450-foot mountain and the second highest volcano in Antarctica, which could erupt at any time. Two groups began their advance toward the summit on March 7th and were held up by a blizzard. They reached the summit rim on March 9th and took rock samples and conducted meteorological experiments. However, the nightmarish wind chill and looming threat of frostbite forced the men to begin a rapid descent, mostly by sliding down snow slopes, covering 5,000 feet of descent in 4 hours. When the party reached Camp Royds on March 11th, they were, quote, nearly dead. Sir Philip Brocklehurst's toes were black with frostbite, and one was later amputated. The expedition wintered in their hut during the months of darkness in their prefabricated structure. It only measured 33 by 19 feet and was divided into two-person cubicles, a small storage, dark room, laboratory, and kitchen. There were horse stalls and dog kennels for their animals, although four of their ponies had already died due to consuming sulfurous volcanic sand. Simple tasks such as fetching fresh ice and depositing of ashes became feats of incredible endurance as the Antarctic winter came on, its ferocious winds and blinding storms plunging temperatures to inhuman levels of cold. Despite their troubles, Shackleton kept the men to a regular schedule throughout the winter to provide structure and keep up their spirits. They had breakfast of porridge and hot milk at 9 a.m. each day, followed by tea and bottled fruit, then a smoke. Lunch was at 1 p.m. and dinner at 6:45. Shackleton also maintained an egalitarian spirit in the camp by not dividing up the men according to rank. When not maintaining the base camp during the days and nights of darkness, he quietly prepared for their assault on the South Pole. The assault would consist of two teams. One was to approach the pole to the south, and a second party was to reach the South Magnetic Pole. The South Pole team consisted of Shackleton, meteorologist Jameson Adams, Dr. Eric Marshall, and provision master Frank Wild. They began their 1,700-mile trek on October 19, 1908, with a full complement of pack animals to drag their supplies across ice. The northern party began their 1,260-mile journey, but lacked members with any polar experience and had to pull their sledges and supplies with no dogs or ponies. The Northern Party did have the benefit of a motor car to establish depots 10 and 15 miles away from Cape Royds, but it overheated soon after. Trouble set in as they quickly ran short of food rations. They suffered snow blindness, frostbite on their cheeks and tips of their noses, and sunburn. On January 15, 1909, the Northern Party abandoned their heavy gear and made a final 20-mile assault on the South Magnetic Pole. They arrived at their destination, planted the Union Jack, posed in front of the camera, and claimed the pole for the British Empire, and gave three cheers for King Edward VII. The men then trudged 25 miles back to their supply depot, gathered their supplies, and returned to the Nimrod. Shackleton's South Pole team set out on October 29, 1908. They marched through the White Plains of Antarctica, trying to avoid deadly crevasses, which they fell into frequently. Like the Northern Party, their food rations quickly ran low. The party shot the weakest pony on November 21st and gobbled down its meat. On November 26th, they passed the previous furthest south record, set by Robert Scott in 1902, but were forced to shoot two more ponies shortly after, and eight pony maize as well. Health problems set in, such as Adam's painful toothache that prevented him from sleep. He finally instructed Marshall to extract it without anesthesia or proper tooth-pulling equipment. But despite all this, Shackleton remained optimistic in his journal entries. He wrote on December 11th that difficulties are just things to overcome, after all. They enjoyed a Christmas feast of medical brandy, cocoa, plum pudding, and cigars. But 250 miles still separated them from the pole, and they only had provisions for three more weeks. They reached the polar plateau on December 27th, facing a terrible headwind. The team then encountered a blizzard on December 30th, slowing their march to a crawl. By January 2nd, Shackleton had to decide whether to make a final assault on the pole or risk starvation. He asked the question, but already knew the answer. They were weakening rapidly, and only 3 days of provisions remained. The group pushed through from January 4th through 7th, through a howling blizzard, only 100 miles from the pole. On January 9th, 1909, Shackleton and the three others had again broken the record for reaching the highest southern point, but knew this journey had to come to an end. They planted the flag, left behind a brass cylinder containing documents and stamps, and took their pictures. The party was only 97 miles from the pole, reaching a latitude of over 88 degrees south. They began their return trip and crossed crevasses on their sledge, surviving only on tea, cocoa, and pony maize. 2 months later, the party reached the Nimrod after a 1,700-mile return. And they basically looked like bearded skeletons at this point. Upon their return to England, the crew received a hero's welcome, particularly its captain. King Edward VII invested Shackleton as a commander of the Royal Victorian Order and later knighted him. He was appointed a younger brother of Trinity House, a major honor for British mariners, and received a gold medal from the Royal Geographic Society. Shackleton published a book of his adventures entitled Heart of the Antarctic. He followed this with three phonographic recordings of the expedition and numerous lectures throughout England. The daily papers praised his feats of courage and endurance. He was invited to exclusive lunches and dinners. He received toasts in the wood-paneled gentlemen's societies of London, and glasses of brandy raised in his honor by the best-known scholars and politicians in the nation. The praise and honor Shackleton received were universal, but his fans overlooked the tragic fact that this national hero had returned to England completely destitute. The costs associated with outfitting a ship for Arctic exploration, obtaining years' worth of provisions, and paying the 2 years' worth of salaries for the crew put him deeply in debt. Shackleton didn't reach the pole, and the expected finances didn't materialize. He couldn't meet the guarantees given to the backers of the voyage. He was only able to meet the most immediate obligations through government action in the form of a grant of £20,000, equal to over £1.5 million today, or nearly $3 million. Due to his celebrity and high regard at the time, it's likely that most debts were either not pressed or written off entirely. Again, as in 1904, Shackleton tried to meet the demands of his creditors by embarking on a series of failed business ventures. He offered a number of celebrity endorsements that were not that much more dignified than a retired NBA star in a deodorant commercial. He promoted a tobacco company, developed a scheme of selling postage stamps to collectors, and took a stake in a Hungarian mining concession. But the only steady income he could muster was through lectures and tours describing his Antarctic travels. It seemed that Shackleton's fate was, for better or for worse, bound to the icy southern continent. Retirement wasn't an option. Despite what he had promised his wife, he confided to others that he wished to return to Antarctica. Shackleton knew it was a matter of time before another explorer beat him to the South Pole, And that fear was realized when news reached England that Norwegian explorer Roald Amundsen had accomplished the feat in December 1911. It was a bitter defeat for the British. Robert Falcon Scott set out to reach the pole at the same time, but arrived 33 days after Amundsen, greeted by a flapping Norwegian flag. He and his four comrades left in utter disappointment. Tragedy struck in their return trip to the Antarctic coast. All expedition members died from a combination of starvation, exhaustion, and cold. Shackleton likely felt further comeuppance when he read how the Norwegian corrected every mistake that Shackleton made during the Nimrod expedition. Amundsen had learned much about Arctic survival from Inuits during his Northwest Passage crossing from 1903 to 1906 and applied these techniques to his journey. He swapped out ponies for a team of 52 Arctic huskies that pulled skis and four sled dogs. He traded heavy parkas for Inuit-style animal skins, which flicked off perspiration, trapped in body heat, and kept its wearer far warmer than the poor explorers who were trapped in sweat-drenched parkas. He planned to kill dogs on the way and use them as a source of fresh meat. No scientific or surveying equipment was brought on the trip. His only goal was to reach the pole, plant a flag, and return home. Because his original hopes had been crushed, Shackleton sought out to achieve a different milestone. He planned to make a continental crossing from Weddell Sea to McMurdo Sound via the South Pole itself. The idea wasn't originally his, but first crafted by Scottish polar scientist William Spears Bruce, who presented it to the Royal Scottish Geographical Society in 1910. Under his scheme, one party would winter near the Coats Land, while their ship took another group around the Ross Sea on the other side of the continent. The land party would then cross the continent on foot and meet the ship, then return home. The 1,800-mile journey, in addition to its historic value, would also be of great scientific importance. The first half of the journey, from the Weddell Sea to the South Pole, was over unexplored territory, and magnetic observations here would be invaluable to geologists and glaciologists studying ice formations. The idea was well received, but ignored due to the current interest in Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition. Following the Scott tragedy, Shackleton dusted off Bruce's proposal and adopted it for his own purposes. Bruce offered his blessing to the plans, since a German expedition had recently attempted it but failed, and he desired that another British subject succeed so that they aren't bested once again by a foreigner like Amundsen. According to Shackleton's plan, the ships would be established as supply depots to assist the expedition on land by providing food and fuel at both ends. The Weddell Sea party of 40 men would travel by Endurance and continue to the Vassal Bay area, where six men, including Shackleton, would form the Transcontinental Party and begin their hike, led by 69 dogs and two motor sledges. The Ross Sea party would travel to the Ross Sea base in McMurdo Sound on the opposite side of the continent and lay depots on the route of the Transcontinental Party, offering them provisions for the return journey and assisting their homeward march. The plan was published publicly in 1914, and Shackleton acquired funding for the expedition on the eve of World War I. The 56 men who responded to Shackleton's challenging ad set out that autumn. The Endurance departed in August, and the Aurora followed in September. Through Shackleton's oversight, the Endurance was refitted to withstand every Arctic contingency. It would transport the Transcontinental Party to the Weddell Sea and then explore the coastlines. It was constructed with triple expansion engines, which gave it a speed under steam of 9 to 10 knots. It was barkentine rigged, weighed 350 tons, and was built of heavy pine, oak, and greenheart. Well, troubling signs appeared not long after Endurance departed for Antarctica on December 5th. As they approached the Vassal Bay, the crew encountered pack ice at a far higher latitude than expected. Their speed slowed, and on December 14th, the ship was forced to halt for 24 hours as it was unable to navigate through the floes. This came as a surprise to Shackleton, who expected such conditions in the Weddell Sea, but not such ice of a, what he called, obstinate character so far north. After spending weeks of slow progress skirting ice walls, Endurance approached an impassable glacier on January 15th. The glacier was considered an acceptable landing site, but was too far north. They continued south to 76 degrees, where the ship sheltered in the lee of a stranded iceberg. Endurance continued south before being stopped altogether, entombed in ice. The crew spent days stranded and cut down on the use of ship heating to save fuel. The crew struggled to release the ship. They hacked away with ice chisels, saws, prickers, and picks to free her. But the efforts were all in vain. Shackleton abandoned plans of establishing a coastal camp and declared that the Endurance would be their winter station instead. He assumed they would remain there until the spring, when the ice could be broken and the ship could resume the voyage. He wasn't worried. The same situation happened to Wilhelm Filchner's expedition 3 years earlier, and his ship eventually broke free of the ice with little harm. Well, unfortunately, his assumption was wrong. Endurance began to drift on its ice floe, and its speed of drift increased. In April, a nearby pack of ice approached the floe. It packed and rafted together so intensely that Shackleton feared his ship would be crushed like an eggshell. They were spared such a fate, but any other plans for exploration went into hibernation, as darkness set in for the Antarctic winter. Like his previous expedition, the captain kept his crew to a strict routine, encouraging them to race the sled dogs, take moonlit walks, and keep their minds engaged. In August, the ice floe began to break up around the ship. As it thawed, though, the ship displayed severe signs of damage. The pressure of its breaking up forced tons of ice beneath the ship's keel and caused a heavy list to port. The ship was gripped in an icy pinch, as if it were between a thumb and finger. The pressure began crushing the hull. On September 30th, the ship experienced its worst squeeze so far. 1 month later, the starboard side was forced against a large floe, which bent the hull with terrible force. Ice water poured into the ship, and Endurance's timbers splintered and cracked. That same month, the order was given to evacuate all men, provisions, and equipment. The ship was swallowed by the sea on November 21, 1915, so we talked about at the beginning of this episode. The 28 crew members abandoned the ship in time, but they couldn't establish a safe shelter. They couldn't drag their boats and stores across the thin frozen sea ice due to fears of it breaking beneath their frozen feet. They could only camp on a large ice floe, hoping to float toward Paulet Island over 250 miles away, where the stores were cached. Temperatures dropped to 15 degrees below zero. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Shackleton set up a more permanent camp, which he dubbed Patience Camp, on another floe, hoping it would bring them to a safe landing. The months passed uneventfully, but their daily food rations were slashed as supplies ran low. The crew subsisted on remaining packaged rations, seal meat, and the final team of dogs, which were shot on April 2nd. Their floe passed by Paulet Island and came within 60 miles of it on March 17th, but they were unable to reach it due to impassable ice. It might have been 600 miles for all the chance we had of reaching it across the broken sea ice, Shackleton recorded. In April, the floe began to break apart and the camp was reduced to a small triangular raft of ice. A further breaking would mean a watery death, so the men were ordered into the lifeboats. Shackleton ordered them north to reach Elephant Island, a stepping stone to Deception Island, which might be passed by whalers or contain provisions. At the very least, it had a small wooden church for whalers, whose timbers could be used to construct a larger vessel. Their boats drifted along, the sailors soaked with icy seawater. Elephant Island was a desolate outcropping of icy rock, with no safe anchorage, 346 miles north of Endurance. Nevertheless, the rocky island was a most welcome sight to the crew. When they made land in the three boats, it was the first time they had stood on solid ground in 16 months. Although their new home had no wildlife or vegetation, and staying there for any length of time promised nothing but disease or starvation or death, the crew was safer now than they had been in a month. But they couldn't stay long. Time was short, and Shackleton knew decisive action was necessary. The best chance for survival was to leave most of the party on Elephant Island, where he and a few sailors chanced an 800-mile open boat journey to South Georgia to seek help. Shackleton and his chosen crew packed 4 weeks of supplies onto the James Caird, a 22.5-foot oak-frame lifeboat, and set sail on April 24, 1916. The crew didn't know it at the time, but their journey was later known as one of the most daring voyages in polar exploration. The lifeboat had an open top and exposed its crew directly to the elements. Its seams were caulked with wax and plugged with oil paint and seal blood. It was permanently dank, dark, and unable to offer any protection from the sea. The tiny vessel rose and crashed with each wave. It was like sitting on a spin axis of a gyroscope. The ship suffered constant threat of being swamped or rolled over. For 17 days, they faced frigid winds, treacherous seas, and gale-force winds up to 50 miles an hour, all while they could barely muster enough energy to steer the vessel due to fatigue from starvation. The winds launched massive waves against them, which Shackleton described as the largest he'd seen in 26 years, although whether this was true or a hallucination from malnutrition is open to debate. They sighted South Georgia on May 8th, and 2 days later came ashore at the uninhabited King Haakon Bay. But their work wasn't over by any means. The crew landed on the island and then collapsed from exhaustion. After a period of rest, Shackleton considered the next step. There were populated whaling outposts on the northern side of the island. They landed on the empty southern side of the island, but decided that an overland journey of the island's unexplored mountain interior was safer than putting to sea again for the weakened crew. Crew members John Vincent and Henry McNish were in a severely diminished state and opted to stay at the new camp to be rescued. The crossing party of Shackleton, Frank Worsley, and Tom Creon set out on May 19th. 25 lives scattered across two rescue camps now depended on them. They embarked on a nonstop 36-hour march through unnamed mountains and glaciers, staggering through multiple backtrackings, a slide down a mountain on a makeshift rope sledge, and a final pass through a freezing waterfall. Finally, after 17 miles of climbing over icy slopes, snowfields, glaciers, and a vertical ascent of 4,500 feet, they reached the station Stromness. As they mustered their last ounce of energy, the three men walked toward the lighted settlement. Then they heard a really strange noise, at least to their ears. It was the sound of a ship's steam whistle, the first sound of civilization outside their own crew since 1914. Shivering with cold, they walked briskly to the whaling station now within sight. The bearded men with their matted hair and tattered and filthy clothes did their best to straighten up and enter the facility with some comportment and dignity. Two small boys greeted them and then fetched the man on duty to talk with them. "Is Mr. Sorley, the manager, in the house?" asked Shackleton. "Yes," he said, staring at them with astonishment. "We would like to see him," he said. "Who are you?" "We have lost our ship and come over the island," he replied. "You have come over the island?" he said with utter disbelief. When Mr. Sorley arrived, the three men were greeted warmly. They were able to wash, shave, and dine on Norwegian cakes and coffee, their first hot beverage in nearly a year. After a meal, a bath, and a change of clothes, Shackleton reflected that they had ceased to be savages and become civilized men again. But they only relaxed for one night before mounting a rescue mission for the two waiting camps at Elephant Island and King Haakon Bay. At the station, they arranged for a whaling boat to be led by Worsley to sail around the coast and pick up their three comrades. Shackleton had saved them from frozen death. He now made preparations to save the other 22 who had been stranded on Elephant Island weeks ago. Frank Wild had been placed in command of the Elephant Island party as they waited for rescue. His purpose was to maintain order and a degree of hope among a party that was fighting a war of attrition against nature. The men were slowly succumbing to frostbite, depression, malnutrition, and the onset of insanity. They expected the rescue party to return to them in a few weeks, unaware of the trouble Shackleton encountered in crossing the ice packs. When the early estimates for his arrival passed, many feared they'd been abandoned or that Shackleton's life raft had capsized in the frozen waters. Some were concerned that they had been forgotten by the outside world. They spent their time crowded in a makeshift hut consisting of two upturned boats placed on low stone walls walled off by canvas. Wild attempted to inspire his crew in the mold of Shackleton. He refused to allow seal and penguin meat to be stockpiled, which would be tacit admission of their captain's failure. Time passed slowly. Weeks slipped into months, and the estimated time of Shackleton's arrival passed unceremoniously. A permanent watch scanned the horizon for rescue, but they saw nothing except the empty sea and the ever-churning ice floes. Whispers of starvation and diminishing food supplies turned to discussions of inevitable cannibalism. Some men proposed launching their own boat trip to Deception Island, succeeding where Shackleton had apparently failed. The discussion halted when a ship was spotted on August 30, 1916. Through the dense fog, a foreign vessel emerged. The boat moved directly toward the camp, as if it knew its final destination with precise coordinates. It was Shackleton aboard Yelcho, a small steam tug lent to him by the Chilean government. The island party erupted in cheers. One man quickly put together a makeshift flare by puncturing a hole in their last tin of fuel, soaking clothes in it, walking to the edge of the spit, and setting them afire for fear the boat would pass them by. At 12:40 p.m., the boat landed. Shackleton was standing on the bow, shouting to Wild, "Are you all well?" he asked. Within an hour, the Elephant Island party was safely aboard, and all were bound for the warmer waters of Punta Arenas. After 105 days on the desolate island, they were saved. Not a single member of Shackleton's party died. Now, of course, it wasn't easy for Shackleton to mount a rescue. It took the captain four attempts to successfully return to Elephant Island. He first left in a large whaler with a volunteer crew, but impassable pack ice had formed 70 miles from the island. He tried again with a trawler on loan from the Uruguayan government, but was again thwarted by the ice. The same result happened when he attempted the voyage once again in a British-owned schooner. His final voyage in August was successful when the seas were temporarily opened. The crew of Aurora, the other boat on Shackleton's expedition, which was tasked with setting out supply depots for the Endurance Party on the opposite side of the Antarctic continent, didn't fare as well. After unloading these supplies and the men in early 1915, it was trapped in sea ice in similar ways as Endurance and drifted out to open waters. 10 men were stranded and 3 died before Shackleton and others arrived to rescue them in January 1917. After all their challenges were overcome and they rescued as many as they could, the crew arrived safely in the Falklands, where they rested, warmed themselves, and recovered their injuries. News of their rescue was sent to Britain by telegraph. The expedition and its fantastic story of endurance and survival was soon the top story in the British press. It was a welcome relief from endless reports of the Great War, which had engulfed the continent and every day brought news of thousands more dead. The crew made its way back to England on a smattering of different ships. England didn't have the resources or the attention span to treat them to a proper hero's welcome due to the war effort. Many of the crew didn't apparently mind, as they turned around and enlisted for service immediately after their return. Shackleton himself was 42 years old and beyond conscription age, but the military saw value in him as a national hero and dispatched him to Buenos Aires to mount a propaganda campaign and persuade the South American countries to join the war. He had little success in this area, so he returned to England and assisted with the British insurgents in Spitsbergen, a northern Russian island somewhat similar to Elephant Island. With these efforts concluded, he eventually returned to the lecture circuit and published South, an account of the Endurance Expedition. He received the honorary rank of Officer of the Order of the British Empire. And yet, the commander didn't seek a comfortable retirement. Perhaps because of his lifelong relationship with adversity, Shackleton gave serious consideration to going to the largely unexplored Beaufort Sea in the Arctic Circle in 1920, even raising interest from the Canadian government. He changed his plans and instead chose to return to Antarctica for oceanographic and sub-Antarctic exploration in an attempt to map 2,000 miles of coastline. Shackleton departed in the 125-ton Norwegian sealer, Quest, in the following September, timing the journey for good weather. By this time, though, he was in poor health. He did his best to disguise it from those around him, blaming his chronic pain on muscular discomfort. The ship arrived in South Georgia in January 1922, but Shackleton died of a heart attack the following day after his arrival at King Edward Cove. He was 47 years old. Though his crew originally sought to return the body, Shackleton's wife requested that her husband be buried in South Georgia. She thought it appropriate to leave his remains at the site of his most heroic moments. A memorial service with full military honors was held at Holy Trinity Church in Montevideo, and a service was also held at St. Paul's Cathedral in London, with the king and the royal family present. The events of Shackleton's life are at once heartbreaking and inspirational. He never succeeded in any of his Arctic expeditions, despite exposing himself to years of cold, misery, starvation, and being on the edge of death. He had brief encounters with celebrity, but much of his time in England was spent begging for funds for a new voyage and cashing in on his fame for humiliating turns of celebrity endorsement. But today he's celebrated as one of the great heroes, if not the greatest hero, of the heroic age of Arctic exploration. Whatever challenge he encountered, the captain proved his character with an incredible resolve. He kept an entire crew alive and survived a dangerous rescue attempt to save them, when lesser captains would have left them to their death, preferring to suffer in the shame of a court-martial trial. His shipmates praised him with the highest praise for his loyalty, courage, and resolve. Alexander Macklin noted that there radiated from him something strong and powerful and purposeful, so that even to meet him was an experience. It was something that I have never come across in anyone else. He valued loyalty above everything. No one ever questioned his authority. Thomas Ord Lees went further, crediting him as the pin that held together their entire expedition. "We seem to be a wonderfully happy family, but I think Sir Ernest is the real secret of our unanimity. Considering our divergent aims and difference of station, it is surprising how few differences of opinion occur." Typical for Shackleton, the world largely forgot his life's heroism and leadership. But as his story became the subject of more research, his star has risen over the last half century. Books, documentaries, and films have appeared that recount his incredible story of survival and averting disaster. Corporate leadership strategists have mined his life for lessons on reaching impossible goals and maintaining team morale in the face of disaster and shifting strategy. In 2011, Nancy Cohn wrote a case study about him for the Hardener Business School, and it drew more interest from executives and MBA students than any other she's taught. In the 21st century, with petty politics, economic crises, Shackleton's commitment to a larger purpose than problems at hand and his flexible, imaginative means to achieve his goals are seen as incredibly important. So in death as in life, Shackleton has withstood failure and found incredible success. All right, that's all for this episode. In the final episode, we're going to do an epilogue to this series on travelers and explorers and ask, what does it mean to be an explorer in the 21st century when almost every part of planet Earth has been explored, GPS has mapped everything, and people are doing stunts where they're recreating famous journeys, but there's not a lot they can do that's original anymore. So we'll see you in the next and final episode in this series. Okay, well, that wraps things up for today's episode. Thank you so much for sticking with me to the end. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraza. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on Earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.